I'm absolutely beyond excited to have Jonah Platt on the line with me. Now, just by way of introduction, he basically descends from Hollywood royalty. There's no other way of putting it. He is extraordinarily talented. He's also brave. He's an actor, writer, he's a musician, and he's a very vocal advocate for Jewish identity and Israel. In my mind, too, he's a podcaster extraordinaire, and I personally haven't missed an episode of Being Jewish with Jonah Platt. Americans know him from Wicked and Broadway. We in South Africa really don't, but suffice it to say that his impact goes far beyond the stage. He's a passionate voice for Jewish causes and a creative force behind new musicals like The Giver, which we'll chat about a little later today. So today we're diving into intersections of art, activism, and identity with Jonah Platt. Jonah, I am delighted that you are talking to us on Chai FM this afternoon.
That was just the kindest, most generous intro, Simon. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here with you all.
I'll take that, but I don't think it was. I think it was deserved to the absolute nth degree. My first question, though, is going to be a real weird and wacky one. So, you're so involved in Jewish issues. I first saw you on video and I thought, but this guy's a Viking who should be called Sven Sorensen. How do you explain that?
I don't know. I guess, you know, my mother's side of the family is where I get the, you know, like the height. My father's side of the family, I'm the tallest Platt on planet Earth, so there's not much going on there. I don't know. Like my parents both have kind of like lighter features. Like my mom's eyes are blue, my dad's eyes are green. Somewhere down the line, we just got some of those other Viking SP, and I can grow a nice beard. I'm, you know, that part is actually Jewish. You know, we're rather hirsute genetically, and I can grow a pretty thick, you know, rabbi beard when I want to.
It's fantastic because you just break the stereotype. So that's just such a good place to start. And then I just thought I'd let you know also, we started this program two, three hours ago where I was saying, you are my fantasy guest at the Friday night dinner in my head. I've got you seated at the table. Uh-huh. Next to you on the left, I think, is Barry Weiss. And on the right, I think, would be Sheryl Sandberg. And I want to know who would your fantasy guests be at your pretend Friday night?
Wow, that's some good conversation at that table. I would love to have Barry at my Shabbat table. That'd be awesome. I'm actually sitting down with her in New York next week.
You're kidding?
Which I'm excited
me.
About.
Oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah. So I've never gotten the chance to actually like converse with her. I actually ran into her on the street in New York, got a big hug last weekend, but I'm going to see her, you know, more formally this week. I would want Paul McCartney at my Shabbat table because A, you know, he's married to a Jewish woman. So there's certainly something to oh yeah. Like there pictures, anytime he shows up in synagogue, you know, he like went to High Holiday services with her a year ago. And those pictures somehow ended up on the internet. Everybody, you know, was super psyched about that. I'm Beatles obsessed. So to have him there and have a reason to have him there beyond just him being a celebrity would be amazing. I would sort of love to talk to him about the ways he's engaged with the community and what he's learned through his wife, Nancy. Let's throw him at the table. And man, who else would be interesting?
Yeah, give me one more.
I'll give you one more. And this is the guest that I've most been wanting to have on my podcast is the musician Pink.
She's Jewish,
she is. Yes, and openly and sort of proudly so. She's reposted my stuff online before. She just hasn't, you know, she sort of speaks through others and like lives her life without actually articulating her own feelings necessarily in a very sort of bold way. And I would love the opportunity just to be able to, you know, be in an intimate setting with her and really understand what it's, you know, what she's going through and what it's like to be her and what how she connects to being Jewish.
Interesting how we all choose different people depending on our particular interests or, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, I've already had dinner at her table, so it's old hat for me.
You know, for me, when she came out and she went to Israel after October the 7th and made that supremely important documentary about the rape, which nobody was talking mm-hmm. about at the time, that was when my respect for her just went off the charts. And I thought, this woman has totally. Everything to lose and nothing to gain. And to a certain extent, Jonah, I put you in the same class, that you had everything to lose and nothing to gain. You come from a very prominent family. You're a somebody in Hollywood. There wasn't anything in it for you to adopt the stance that you have adopted. Just talk to me about that. What drove you? What were the seminal events? How did this happen?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll disagree with you entirely. To me, it feels very much the opposite. That if I had said or done nothing, I would have lost so much more. And doing what I've been doing since October 7th, I have gained multitudes. So it really, you know, I know it can look scary from the outside to sort of make that leap, but it's sort of like Harry Potter platform 9 3/4. Like, it looks like you're going to run into a brick wall, but on the other side, if you go through it, you know, you get to go be a wizard at Hogwarts. So it's like, it's all wins. For me, it wasn't even really, part of it was not a choice. In the aftermath of October 7th, I just found myself spending all of my time engaged online mostly, but also in real life in a lot of ways with the Jewish community. I wanted to be helping. I wanted to be in the mix. I wanted to be clarifying and educating and listening to people. And that part, like, I literally didn't think twice about it. I just followed what my energy wanted to do and like where I wanted to be spending my time. And after a couple of months of that, where it was very sort of reactive and defensive and putting out fires, I sort of was like, okay, I want to get back to really what my Jewish advocacy mission kind of has always been. You know, it's organically grown over the last 5 years, but if you were going to trace it, you would see it's really education is a piece of it, but the bigger piece is sort of celebrating Jewish identity and leaning into it and trying to empower others to do the same. And I just really wanted to get back into that, because to me that's the reason for it all. And by the way, it happens to be, I think, the number one antidote for the anti-Jewish sentiment in the world is an empowered, confident, connected, open, proud Jewish community. So that's where I put my energy since, you know, beginning of 2024, and here we are, fall of 2025, and you know, it's my full-time gig, really.
I picked up on what you just mentioned a moment ago. You said anti-Jewish hatred, and because I've listened to so many of your podcasts, I'm very aware that you've got a thing about the term anti-Semitism.
Yes, I do. You're listening. I appreciate it. I love that.
Get the stats. You'll see I'm your number one listener in Africa. There's no question about
Amazing.
That.
Amazing.
But I want you to talk to that, because I don't think it's an issue that is spoken about here in South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, the issue for me, and it's something that I have come face to face with because of my work a lot of times, is, look, that word was not even invented by a Jewish person, right? I mean, it was invented by, you know, a pseudoscientist trying to make it, you know, opaquely academic and sort of difficult to talk about. And that's the result. I mean, you find that with that term, because the nature of anti-Semitism, it is so unwieldy and amorphous and constantly changing and shape-shifting and encompasses so many different things. The term itself, it's so difficult to connect with people. A lot of people don't know what it means. They don't think that whatever they're doing falls under that category. That happens all the time, where like, oh, but I posted something in support of the hostages. So when I do X, Y, and Z, like, clearly I'm not an anti-Semite. But if I can reframe it and say, like, hey, when you did X, Y, and Z, like, that is, you know, a bigoted thing to do the way you did that. Like, let me explain how that's prejudice. Let me explain how that's, like, racism towards Jewish people. That connects more. And it also, I think, it's very easy to sort of brush off the term. I'm not an anti-Semite. That doesn't really mean anything to me. But if you tell someone you're a Jew hater, you're an anti-Jew bigot, like that stings. That leaves a mark. That's something you have to contend with. And then lastly, you know, something I ran into all the time, I'm sure a lot of people do, is you get the like, well, Arabs are Semites, or, you know, Jews aren't the original Semites.
Yes,
or you get into the semantics, yes, of that word. 100%. And then we're just talking about nonsense instead, yeah, of talking what we should be talking about, which is the way Jews are being affected by bigotry.
I want to take you back to October the 7th, because I think that is, you know, in my parents' day, it was everybody knew where they were when Kennedy was shot. I think in our lifetimes, it's where were we on the 7th of October. What was your 7th of October story?
So what's interesting is it actually kind of wasn't that for me. Like for me, my moment like that is 9/11. Like I can picture every second of that, finding out about 9/11. October 7th was different for me because I was out of town. I think I was at a wedding. And so like it was an unfamiliar place. So like I can't even picture it because I was only in it for a few hours. Like I don't remember the hotel room. And for me, less finding out the news like that exact moment, because it was really like an unfolding, right? I mean, it wasn't like a 9/11, like I'm watching a plane crash into a tower and that's the event on television. It was what's happening, more information, more video, things are unfolding. Oh my God, that's awful. Oh my God, that's even more awful. And it lasted for days, really. And you're hearing things trickling in from people you actually know in Israel and from influencers and from the news and X, Y, and Z. So the part that really sticks with me is not necessarily that day itself, but really the follow-up, and like October 8th, 9th, 10th, when I was, you know, glued to my phone and my computer, and I was doing multi-hour Instagram Q&As trying to just help people understand any part of what was going on. And, you know, what surprised me and made me feel glad that I was doing what I was doing is the amount of Jews, connected Jews, but, you know, American diaspora Jews who lacked a lot of the facility with the language of this conflict and the details. And people were learning a lot from me of stuff that to me seems, you know, kind of basic and foundational, yeah. But not self-evident necessarily, but like I would hope people would have learned this part. And this isn't a judgment. I'm not upset that they haven't, but like it clearly was a very much needed. And that's really what stays with me. And people sort of sharing on Instagram this like 2-hour video of me answering questions, being like, hey, this is 2 hours, but you really need to know all this stuff.
Jonah, I'm going to stop you.
That's what sticks with me.
I'm going to stop you there for just 1 minute. I have to go to an ad break. Wait for me. I'm going to come back in 1 minute.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'm Simon Anstey, and you're listening to The Home Run on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm in the midst of conversation with Jonah Platt. Just saying that just makes me think it can't actually be real, but it is because he's there. Jonah, no, well, listen, we're off the radar. We're not in your sights. We know about American Jewish communities and French Jewish communities. Nobody knows about South Africa, so it's good to have you.
I see the South Africans. You know, I have South Africans in my life and people who have moved from South Africa to America. And you know, you mentioned The Giver earlier. My director on that lives in South Africa and is South African. So I've got connections and, yeah, hope to visit one day for sure.
We turn up in the weirdest of places. That's for sure. That's absolutely for sure. So, you know, talking about South African Jews, we very aware of our place in the society. We were a very small minority. We've been leaving since the 60s. We knew our place. American Jews were very, very different. You were almost Mayflower type Jews. You arrived very early on. Your ethos is part of the ethos of the American Republic. Having said that, were you shocked by the response to October the 7th as an American Jew?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everybody was shocked. It's sort of like a shock and then an understanding of, oh, we sort of shouldn't have been shocked. Like, this is how it has always gone and been. And it, like, I get it. And once you sort of see all of the hard work our enemies have been doing to build to this moment, it makes a lot of sense why we're in the moment we're in. But yes, absolutely, just shocking to see how effective in real time propaganda is and has been, and sort of the deep-seated indoctrination that has gone on to prime certain people in our society to flip that switch and turn on Jews and fall into these, you know, bigoted tropes and actions instantly. Very, very shocking and how quickly it's descended.
Jonah, I need double time with you, and I'm going to ask you to come back because we are very nearly out of time, and we haven't even scratched the surface. A final question for you today before we play out with Ahavat Olam, and I've been singing that all week at traffic lights, so it's your fault.
Ah, nice.
But yeah, it is nice. We'll get there. Final question. Are you surprised by the powerlessness of American Jews?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I've not heard it framed that way. I wouldn't say we're powerless. I don't think we are. I think the issue really is that we're not unified enough in our strategy or in our messaging. And we're just not together enough. Everybody's a little bit siloed. It's all the issues American Jewry had before this still exist. And that's that we're fractured politically. We're fractured along observance lines. We're fractured geographically. I mean, obviously, you know, America's enormous. So it's just tough to feel that like real togetherness, that we're all on the same page. We just aren't. And then also, you know, there's the old adage of like, you know, two Jews, three synagogues, sure, kind of a thing. You know, nobody agrees on anything. It's intrinsic that we are. We debate and we argue and we don't agree on stuff. And it's sort of biting us in the butt a little bit now because we're just so much stronger together. If there were, you know, millions of voices united as one, it would be a little bit different, especially in terms of pulling the levers of power than relying on individuals and different sort of interests and groups and agendas to try to get things done. But people are certainly recognizing that. And while there are so many initiatives happening, within that, there is also the recognition of, wow, there are a lot of initiatives happening. We need to start sort of pulling together on this. And I hope that's going to unfold over the next years and decades, and that we're going to see a shift in how American Jewry approaches its place and its responsibilities to Jewry at large, and we got to fix it, and we're way behind, we're playing catch up. But
I have to leave it there. I am really upset about doing that. We will contact you and try to set up a follow up. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, and keep doing what you're doing, because boy, it's important.